You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
All right, break it down, people. Welcome back to the show. I'm Matt Carter, and I'm excited because this is the second week that we premiered live on Adobe Radio. That's going really well. I really want to thank them. That's a big deal to get picked up and heard by so many people on internet streaming radio. So if you're listening that way, really, seriously, welcome. My name's Matt Carter, and I have people on this show to talk about stuff that's interesting to me. I'm a musician. I'm in the band Emery. I've been doing podcasting and music for a long time. And so what I really want to do here is talk about the stuff that's interesting. So it's often music, but today it's not. Today I'm talking about the ketogenic diet, which is essentially a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet that I've been doing for this year. Lost about 25 pounds now. And so I have an expert on, a nutritionist named Carol Freeman, who's going to join me today. So I think you'll be interested to hear this conversation and what we talk about, whether it's new to you or if you're already keto adapted, as we say. Okay, so get a little business out of the way, tell you about a couple things, and we'll hit right to it. Now, number one, thank you to everybody who supports the show by shopping on Amazon. Go to breakitdownpod.com, and over there, there's an Amazon link that I want you to bookmark, and anything you buy through Amazon will support the show without you having to directly give. But speaking of directly giving, if you'd like to pay for this show, which is free, feel free. I think it will increase your enjoyment, and you'll get some pleasure out of knowing that you're supporting me, helping me pay for childcare, equipment, stuff like that. So go to breakitdownpod.com. You can find both of those things. Now, I told you last week about the Taste of Chaos tour, and I've got to tell you about it again because it's really exciting. Now, if you hadn't been paying attention, the Taste of Chaos tour has Dashboard Confessional, Taking Back Sunday, Seosin with Anthony Green, and the early November. There's a full U.S. tour. It's going to go everywhere starting June 3rd, and then it ends in San Bernardino with this like crazy festival version of the tour, and that's going to be on July 16th. There's a bunch of other acts, awesome stuff, including Reggie and the Full Effect, I think, is going to be on that one. So go to jabberjaw.soundrink.com and use this coupon code BREAK to get $5 off any VIP upgrade. So you should go. You should get the VIP. They've got some really good deals, and you're going to get $5 off, which I'm sure this tour and the VIP is going to be a blast. So don't forget, use the coupon code BREAK, $5 off your VIP upgrade. So definitely something you got to do. And then one more thing, I told you about this too. I'm going to tell you the rest of the month, in fact, because this is exciting. And then what I'm talking about is Jimmy Eat World's online store that they're doing with Kings Road merch. Here's what they've done. They've brought back the entire catalog of recut colored vinyl for all the Jimmy Eat World stuff. They got Static Prevails, there's Clarity, which is my favorite, Bleed American, Futures, and Chase the Light, along with the EP Stay on My Side Tonight. That's all on, and that one, the EP, that's the very first time it's ever been on vinyl. So quite special, quite cool indeed. Some of these are close to selling out, so you really should go get these. If you're into vinyl, if you're into Jimmy Eat World, it's kind of a no-brainer. So head to kingsroadmerch.com/Jimmy for this, and they got a bunch of other cool stuff too there. So kingsroadmerch.com/Jimmy.
Break it down, Dada.
Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down.
With Matt Carter.
Yeah. Well, Carol Freeman, thank you for coming to Break It Down.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's always quite a treat to have somebody on, or whenever you can do something in person, because in podcasting, it's always like it's over the internet, and there's a little bit of delay, and people don't understand that. They say I interrupt people a lot, which I do, and I will to you, but it's worse when there's a delay on the internet as far as communicating. So it's really nice to have somebody in person and enough to, in a place like this where we can sit down and actually do video and be on the internet video too. So.
My pleasure, especially on this gorgeous Seattle day that we're having here, record temperatures.
Yeah, so. It really is. And I also hope you don't think of this funny, but I also appreciate it whenever I can get a female guest.
Oh, okay.
And because this, I don't, again, people would say you don't ever have enough women on the show, and it's, and I, that's not intentional. So I, on one hand, I don't want to affirmative action and just go find women to prove that I'm not opposed to having women on the show, but when there's a woman that knows stuff and has stuff that I'd like to talk about, even better.
Well, great.
Kind of thing.
I'm glad I can represent.
And so you're a, I'm going to call you a ketogenic nutritionist.
Yeah.
Does that work?
That's a specialty that I specialize in, yes.
Well, that way, that's the purposes for which I'm interested in talking to you, at least. So that's the label that, that I'll give that, if that suits you. But you also have a master's degree in just nutrition, and tell me what it is.
Well, it's a double master's degree, so it's both in nutrition, and it's called clinical health psychology, which you can just think of it as like mental health counseling from behavioral health aspect. So,
but because I guess I can see what the point of that is. I'm guessing is because the knowing what food you ought to eat is probably just less, a lot less than half the battle, right?
Well,
like it's the habits and what you choose to do despite your knowledge is a big part of it.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of goes both ways. So you've got, you know, making a big change like ketogenic diet that we're talking about here. There's a lot of psychology that goes into that. But also what you eat affects your psychology and your mind. We can talk about that more as well. Some of the really amazing effects that have on the brain, the ketogenic diet has on depression, anxiety, Alzheimer's and stuff. So,
Well, I do want to talk about that, but and I don't want to be remedial or anything, but I do feel like we have to go through some of what the ketogenic diet is. Although I'm really impressed with how prominent, and maybe it's just because I've been doing it for a while that I notice it a lot, but it really does seem like it's out there in a way that it hasn't been before in recent years. Like, am I right about that? Like it's been around. There's versions of it have been around, but I hear it all the time from different sources now. All of a sudden, is that just because I'm paying attention?
Yeah, I wonder. And too, here in Seattle, we kind of have a bubble of progressive people that maybe are a little more cutting edge. I still think it's a very small portion of the population that knows about it. But when you start getting into circles and groups and forums that are into that, then your worldview starts to change a little bit.
If you're looking for a Honda. Yeah. To buy one, you see it everywhere.
Exactly.
Kind of thing. So that might be part of the effect going on. So, but I don't think everybody knows what it is. And essentially, one way to look at it is you could call it a low-carb, high-fat diet. LCHF, you see that acronym around a lot.
I would add moderate protein. So that's one of the things that sets it apart from an Atkins diet, for example.
Because the Atkins diet is what? Different?
It typically is unlimited protein.
Unlimited. So this is not even high protein. It's lower or moderate protein.
Exactly.
Because protein itself can be anti-ketogenic.
Exactly.
When you get over, I don't know. That's what I want to talk about. Here's what's interesting to me from the way I look at it is, and if you say Atkins, people freak out. There's tons of ways that people think about this stuff. But I don't really like to think about diets or fad diets. And everybody's been through this phase and that phase and the caveman this and the blood type this and the Atkins this and it all kind of seems like it comes and goes. So to me, I like to try to learn how metabolism, food, and science work and then let that inform just what I eat without trying to follow somebody's plan. So that's kind of my intent, is to help other people understand your body and nutrition, and then you can decide how you want to eat and look at it as pros and cons and less like a I guess it's weird because you want to look at it less of what's good or bad and just what are your goals and what are you trying to accomplish kind of thing. And so for this one, I think the biggest thing that freaks people out is when you tell them it's high fat. That's obviously the biggest barrier is it's high fat. And I've done my calculator with my macro breakdown kind of thing on it. So you tell me if this is right. But from what I've seen, read with my BMI and my height and my weight, trying to eat just around 2,000 calories a day right now, and I'm trying to get 5% of those from carbohydrates, which is about 25 carbs. And then I'm getting around 100 grams of protein total, which is 21% of my total calorie intake for the day. And then I'm doing about 160 grams of fat a day, which is 74% of the calories I consume are coming from fat.
What's your goal? Are you trying to lean up? Are you trying to bulk up? Are you trying to power your brain? What's your main goal?
I've played around with low-carb diets for 10 years. And I just, whenever I do it, I just feel like this is awesome. But okay. never as much as this time. Like, I've done it on and off for fun or with other people. I've never been really overweight, but this year I got to the heaviest I've been. I was 203 pounds at New Year's and said, all right, let's just go low carb. And as I got into low carb this time, I found the keto kind of community and even more support than before. And then I finally got some even really better understanding mechanically of how it works. And now I just am just so into it. I dropped about 23 pounds.
Okay.
But I wasn't feeling too big. That really wasn't the issue. But I just, the benefits of the way it makes me feel is so convincing. Yeah. And then the science behind it is so convincing that it is just a good, it's better. It just seems like just the healthier way to eat, but I have a hard time convincing people of it.
Yeah. I mean, just yesterday when I go into Starbucks and get a, you know, an iced coffee and I tell them heavy cream make sure heavy cream, not the Breve stuff. And they're like, oh, really? And I said, well, yeah, I specialize in this in my private practice. And
like, they're already judging you just to get just the barista.
Yeah. Yeah. And she says, well, that works if you have a healthy heart though, right?
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, I'm going to leave now because we're not going to.
So, yeah, because the thing is, I mean, the simplest way people think about it is, well, if I eat fat, that equals I get fat.
Yeah, or it clogs your arteries as
well. Or clogs your arteries is the other thing, yeah. And so, okay, I'll just I'm talking enough here. How is that not the case?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Well, I mean.
Let me get a little closer here.
All right.
Feel free. There you go. Get right up on it. People will appreciate it because your voice will sound more commanding if you're close to the mic.
I don't want to lick
it
the microphone
here.
It's
just fine. You're perfect. Just ignore it, but don't be afraid of it.
It's red. It's like a clown's nose right below me here. Well, so there was actually, I mean, we've been sold a bill of goods the last 30 years. We were told that fat was evil, that it clogged our arteries, it caused heart disease. But the truth was that it was all a theory.
Uh-huh.
And the people that proposed it 30 years ago.
Well, it's at least obvious. Fat makes you fat.
Well, yeah. I mean, the people that proposed it 30 years ago, though, it was just a theory, and they believed so strongly in it that they pushed the government to push through these regulations to reduce fat. And so they've been trying for 30 years to come up with some research. They were trying to prove it all this time. And then finally they gave up after 30 years and they realized the opposite was really true. And so it breaks down basically to hormone signaling. So insulin is one of the signals that tells your body to store fat in the body. And fat does nothing to release insulin. It's the only, you know, protein, fats, and carbs. It's the only one that has no effect on insulin. And so fat doesn't signal your body to store fat. It turns out it's carbohydrates.
Yeah. So insulin, everybody knows that, for instance, a diabetic. So the pancreas makes insulin, and if your blood sugar gets high, you will die. If your blood sugar just simply gets too high and you can't fix it with insulin from the pancreas, is fatal, and that's why people can die if they have type 1 diabetes or whatever, right? But insulin itself is a hormone that signals fat storage. Is that right? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean,
so if you just think about it on that way, is it a good idea to make your blood sugar go high? Yes, if you want a hormone to turn on that says store fat now.
Right, right. I mean, the analogy is that farmers have known for years to fatten up the cows, you feed them grain. You know, so feed them a high carbohydrate diet, and that's what fattens up cattle.
True.
I mean, that was something that was, I think that was in Atkins' book, his original book back in the 60s. So he'd figured it out, but we started to buy into this, you know, fat being bad myth that was going around.
But it is bad if you're also, I mean, if you have a ton of extra calories floating around that are from fat and protein, and you have too many calories and the insulin's triggered, then that fat will be stored as fat as well.
Yeah. The absolute worst diet that you can eat is high carb and high fat.
Right.
And that's what most of the United States people are eating right now. High fat, high carb.
Right.
That is a recipe for most of the chronic diseases we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing high fat without the high carbs, then for most people, that's very healthy, and it brings about some really...
I'm glad you said that for most people, because certainly it's not, everything's not uniform, and everybody's different in the way their body handles stuff. Like, some people have a higher carb tolerance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that breaks down to genetics and gut biome and previous life habits and...
So the whole thing is people talk about it as if it's a switch. So there's you're either in fat storage mode or fat burning mode. Is that... Are we getting close to what ketosis is? Does that describe it?
Well, I guess I don't know that I would, because you could not lose weight and be in ketosis. So, mm-hmm. for example, people with epilepsy or brain tumors, especially small children, they can be on a ketogenic diet and they're not losing weight.
Uh-huh.
So they're just in fat burning mode.
But what I mean by that is this: your fuel source. Your fuel source is either going to be sugar. So maybe does it break down, like, if you just thought of it like man designed to live in earlier times when food was scarce,
mm-hmm.
you would, I think that's part of what this is, where if, or like a bear or something, you build up fat. So you want to be storing fat if food is scarce, and you mm-hmm. have a time when you can get all this abundant food, and you have berries and meat, and you had all this stuff, you would feast as much as you can and hope to get as fat as you can.
Right, right.
And then in the winter months, or when things are lean, or when you have to travel across a continent, it's going to be lean, and then you're going to be in fat burning mode that whole time. You're going to be burning your stored fat. And during that time, you will not have your blood sugar and insulin level will be low, and you would begin ketosis, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why the preponderance of the United States population right now, and a lot of the world population, is that, you know, we evolved, if you will, to survive those situations mm-hmm. you described. And so that's a preponderance of the people that we have now are all those ones that are really good at storing fat and mm-hmm. the presence of excess carbohydrates. And then, but we never get the off switch. So we never get that carb deprivation state anymore, right?
Hit that. So it's only a one-way ticket.
So it's just fat storage all the time. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, because we're not getting exposed to that metabolic flexibility of having to burn, you know, having to go back into ketosis, fat burning mode, then because our cortisol and insulin mm-hmm. and glucose are too high all the time, then it's just starting to cause all those chronic diseases, or diseases of civilization, you might say, too.
So, yeah, because we're not using both modes that humans are adapted for. Right. So what, when you go into ketosis, what exactly happens? So you go 24, 48 hours without enough carbohydrates, and then what happens?
Yeah, I kind of think of it as kind of three phases that you've got to adapt to. So the first part is that cut down on carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. Most people do restrict down to 20 grams or less per day as kind of a guaranteed get into ketosis mode. So you've got to starve your body of the carbohydrates first, but it still wants to burn carbohydrates. So it goes to its only storage place, which is liver glycogen.
Mm-hmm.
For most people, your liver stores about 3 to 5 days worth of glycogen mm-hmm. in there. So that is what your body turns to first when you start restricting carbohydrates. So for the first 3 to 5 days, you're still not in ketosis.
Right.
You're still burning carbs, you're still using the glycogen storage.
And burning carbs specifically means that our cells are getting fuel from glucose in the blood?
Yeah, right, okay. Right. Or probably, you know, which is also dietary carbohydrates, right, right.
And dietary carbohydrates as they come in. And
yeah,
so
I guess,
we turn carbohydrates and sugars into glucose either immediately or the liver shoots them out into our bloodstream as needed.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. And, you know, maybe as basic as a lot of people don't realize that, you know, bread and pasta mm-hmm. and even fruit, things that don't even taste sweet on our tongue, like bread, for example, or whole grains,
mm-hmm.
our body still breaks them down into sugar and into glucose in our blood.
All right. And so now your liver's out of glycogen. Now what?
Yeah. So now your body's got to go for another fuel source. And for most people, their body's really rusty at using fat as its primary fuel. And so, mm-hmm. That next phase, so let's say it took 3 days for somebody to burn through their liver glycogen, their body's got to now start increasing the production of enzymes mm-hmm. that allow them to take that stored fat and use it as fuel. And so there's the second phase I think of as that fat adaptation then is where the body's kind of gearing up and amping up the production of those enzymes and just getting better at taking stored fat, mm-hmm. using that for energy, making ketone bodies.
It's a transition thing. The third day whenever I go out or back into ketosis or I just start the diet, that's the third day is when I feel not really good.
Okay.
And for me, it's only maybe a half of one day or one day where I feel irritable and a little bit foggy.
Okay.
That's me. I've heard other people report worse. Not that bad. I don't even really dread it. But some people report worse than that during that time of making the switch. How about you?
Yeah. For me, it hit about day five. And mm-hmm. a lot of people call it the keto flu.
Yeah.
There's some thought that part of it is electrolyte imbalance, because ketogenic diets very has a very strong diuretic effect. Another part is the carb withdrawal. So it's actually just like a drug withdrawal that your brain goes through. Yeah. And, you know, it feels very similar to, from what I understand, to be like a heroin withdrawal. It can be
that makes
shakes
sense.
And body aches and really seriously like a flu feeling for me.
I didn't think about that. That makes sense. Yeah. I was thinking it was had to do with the fact that your brain is changing its fuel source at that, like it's first, because your brain normally takes glucose and that goes right in and is your brain power, which, you know, what's interesting I saw is to really realize that the brain uses like 20 or 25% of your calories is just to power your brain. And you know, it really uses that fuel source. So but it's also able to use ketones once the glucose is gone. So I figure maybe that makes it. That's just a guess, but maybe that's the part of like your brain's kind of freaking out because it's changing fuel sources.
Yeah, I haven't heard that theory, but you know, frankly, there's probably not a lot of research on keto flu and exactly the physiology of what's going on in the body or the biochemistry of it. So
do you think of ketones as a macronutrient?
I mean, technically in the nutrition field, they're not. Uh-huh. They're something different. They would be considered like a metabolite, but they're not a macro. So macronutrients are things we get from food. We can't get ketone bodies from our food. So just like, you know, have you studied the Krebs cycle or the TCA cycle? There's all those metabolites in there as well. None of those are considered macronutrients.
I see. Let me see. See if I'm rusty on this, but I did go to pre-med school in biology. And one of the main things you learn in biology is the real detailed process
of
Krebs, respiration, and photosynthesis. Mm-hmm. That's the things you spend like the whole first semester on, whatever.
And you're like, why do I ever need to know this?
They call it the citric acid cycle as well, right?
Yeah,
and it's like a NAD pH production and pyruvate and acetyl-CoA, that kinds of those kinds of things.
Yeah,
I don't remember the ins and outs of it, but I can. And this is a big round chart and it has all these reactions that happen around it.
And then do you remember the carnitine shuttle?
No.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I dropped out before that.
That's an alternate pathway. That's basically the fat metabolism, how your body gets energy from fat is the carnitine shuttle. So maybe you learned it and you blocked it out.
Well, I remember Krebs cycle sticks out as definitely something I did. But well, let's get into it. I don't know if we're over in the weeds to some degree. What kind of foods can we eat? Like, let's just shift. What did you eat today?
Oh gosh. Well, so I mean, I naturally do intermittent fasting. Uh-huh. I don't know if you've talked about that or not.
No, I haven't, but I'm interested.
I tend to not wake up hungry. I'll have coffee in the morning and I make some kind of a fatty concoction to go in my coffee. So this morning it was coconut milk beverage, which is low carb naturally, but then I add coconut oil to that. Mm-hmm. And this morning I added some cocoa powder to that. Mm-hmm. And I have several cups of coffee in the morning. That's typically what I have like for breakfast. And I knew I was going to go out to dinner later tonight with a friend, and so I wasn't really hungry before I came down, but I grabbed a handful of pepperoni slices, and then I had some cream and some coffee as well. So I haven't had much to eat, but I'm not hungry. Mm-hmm. I feel like I could keep going. So this is where
this all starts to work. If you're following us so far, at this point, what we're saying is you eat fat, cream, pepperoni, as much fat as you can get with carb restrictions. And the idea is that your appetite is wildly suppressed. Like it really, and thus we lose weight.
And you get all the other health benefits of it too. So,
but the billboard one for everybody that gets them, you know, like you can say, oh, there's health benefits to eating kale. I'm not going to do it. But if you tell me that you will lose 20 pounds and there's health benefits, maybe that's worth, you know, looking into it and having a little bit of discipline.
I know, you're right. That's what people are willing to pay money for, or that's what they really want. In my program that I have, I insist that everyone come up with more reasons than that, because it's really easy then if some food is really tempting to you to go, oh, well, if it's only for weight loss, like I can do that tomorrow. So I'm going to eat this instead. Whereas if somebody has a bigger reason, like they want to get rid of their migraine headaches that have been debilitating them, or they want a pain in their foot that's kept them from walking for a year. Mm-hmm. Or for me, I was bedridden for 3 months and I wanted to get well and go back to work. So for me, that was why I do this.
Why were you bedridden?
2 years ago, I was in a really bad car accident. A lot of serious health problems couple of waves of different symptoms. One was crush injuries to my legs, and then the second wave was neuroendocrine problems. So kind of a issue going on with my brain. It wasn't working right. So caused all of my endocrines in my body, endocrine glands, to not work correctly. Wow. So yeah, so that's my big reason. And then as a side effect, yeah, I lost a lot of weight as well. And it was like, all right, I'll take it. But that's my biggest reason is this other health
stuff. And how did you get into it? Who told you were aware of it as a nutritionist?
Well, I only had like a little exposure in school. It wasn't, we didn't get any big education about it. It was mentioned in almost in passing that this was a therapeutic diet that was used to treat epilepsy. That's about all I learned about
Which is crazy too. And I want to get back to that, but I still want to talk about what foods we eat.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't, but so how did you find this diet though? Like, who turned you on to it?
Well, you know, being bedridden, and I mean, my symptoms were a mile long as to far as how sick I really was. And I went to doctor after doctor and nobody could really help me. They didn't know what was wrong or offer any solutions. And so I just started researching on my own. And I actually found, you know, post-traumatic hypopituitarism is what I believe that I had. And then I started having lab results that confirmed that. And I couldn't find a doctor that knew how to treat that either. And they're like, okay, great. If that's what you have, good luck to you. Right.
That's so, what it is, yeah.
So I, you know, my training is like, how do I help my body heal itself? And I started thinking about, okay, so what do I know nutrition wise? Okay. I've heard of this ketogenic diet and helping the brain for epilepsy. Maybe it'll help my body, you know, my brain heal itself. And so I just started reading everything I could find on it. And the more I read, I thought, gosh, I think this is really going to work. And I knew that it takes about 90 days to really get adapted to it. And so that's the first commitment I made to myself, was like, I'm going to try this for 90 days. If it doesn't help me feel any better, I'll give it up, but I'll at least give it a good try. And it didn't even take that long. It was just, you know, in the first few days, all my symptoms started to go away, and the chronic pain I was having in my legs as well, subsided. And even now, 10 and a half months later, I still notice more things that are like, wow, that's so much better now too. And
I hate to purport it. Or first of all, I ain't no commercial. I don't have any book to sell or nothing like that. I just think it's interesting, so I'm interested in talking about it. But it does almost, I don't want to say it's magical, all the stuff it cures, but it feels, I mean, I definitely have you know, less pains. That it's just clear, and I'm not a person to want to believe in that kind of stuff is even true, but for sure, neck pain when I sleep, back pain, things like that. Things that may be related to inflammation, maybe. I'm not sure. Maybe it's just having a few less pounds, but it is different.
It's definitely, I mean, there's research to validate that it's very anti-inflammatory. And that also goes against what we were taught. I mean, even I was taught in school that saturated fats are pro-inflammatory and animal proteins are pro-inflammatory. So you need to avoid those.
All right, so don't avoid animal protein.
No, and saturated fats are anti-inflammatory. Like, you know, my labs show that my inflammation within the first 2 weeks of doing this dropped 70% in my body.
So eat pepperoni.
I mean, that's not an everyday thing for me, but it was something I had that was quick and easy to grab. And
coconut oil is saturated fat.
Yes.
Olive oil is saturated, unsaturated.
No. One of the tests you can know is that if it's solid at room temperature, depending on the temperature, because coconut oil is lower. Solid at room temperature is a saturated fat. So like butter, coconut oil, palm oil is saturated, lard, you know, a steak, the fat in the steak is going to be saturated as well.
And so is, but do you think even between those two, saturated and unsaturated, you should do less saturated? Does it matter to you?
No, from what
people are going to say, well, blood work. What about your HDLs and LDLs? You're going to clog your arteries if you eat saturated fat. That's what people say.
Yeah,
and maybe is there something to that? My doctor says maybe watch the saturated fats. Well, although my blood work is good.
Yeah. I mean, that's what people see over and again, is that they follow ketogenic diet, they eat more saturated fat than they've ever eaten, and their blood work is better than it's ever been. And it's
so you have no shame on saturated versus unsaturated. Like you say it doesn't matter.
No.
Crisco is just as good as olive oil to you?
Not Crisco.
Okay.
Well, so, you know, people will say like, well, it's okay if you eat fat as long as you eat the good fats, right? And that definition is kind of morphed as well. Even for me, I still call bad fats hydrogenated fats. So like Crisco, trans fats, hydrogenated fats.
Okay.
Those are pretty universally labeled bad, right? Okay. Like I don't think there's anybody out there in the nutrition world that would argue those are good fats. So we can all agree on one thing.
Okay.
Probably the area that's kind of gray then, where you might see the two different sides disagreeing, is that you still have a lot of nutrition professionals that are saying like seed oils, like liquid oils are healthy, right? So like sunflower oil or safflower oil, those are what they would label as healthy, but they're really high in omega-6, and omega-6 fats actually are more pro-inflammatory than saturated fats.
So you don't
fats.
Like seed oils?
No. Olive oil, I think it's great. It has a long history of use. It's been used for more than 5,000 years.
Everybody's pretty big on that.
Yeah, and they can extract it in very simple way.
It's unsaturated too, so.
Yeah, and it's got some good compounds in it. And it's, you know, they can chop the olives up, press those, and that's how it comes out. Whereas all the other seed oils that are out there, you know, think about how do they make canola oil?
I don't know.
Exactly. Like you can't squeeze a canola seed and the oil just drips out of it. They've got to do a lot of chemical processing to it, and it doesn't exist in nature. So that's one of my tests of, you know, is this something that should be put in our body? Mm-hmm. Does it exist in nature that way? Or is it close to the way it exists in nature?
Yeah, and fats are a big part of that. So I'm eating a crazy amount of avocados.
Okay.
That's a good one, right?
I love those too, yeah.
Avocados and eggs and sausage, I could just eat all the time.
Yeah.
You know, which is weird because they say a breakfast, people think, oh, we've gotten all... I'll tell you what, I'll eat a light breakfast. I'll have an apple and a bagel.
Okay.
That's all. I'll have a light breakfast, people would think. But that's terrible. Right.
I thought you were just telling me that was your keto breakfast.
No, it's not my keto breakfast. I'm saying I'm just going to have a croissant and maybe an orange.
And a white chocolate mocha.
And then, but instead I say, you know, how about sausage, bacon, avocado, and two eggs?
Yeah.
And that's the worst. That sounds like the worst artery clogging thing in the world. But how is it not?
Well, because...
and I'll lose weight on that.
Yeah. Well, so the myth, part of the myth is that, you know, you eat fat and it goes straight in your veins and it clogs it. Mm-hmm. You probably can see online, if you look up, people share that meme that shows like, you wouldn't pour bacon fat down your drain. Why would you eat it, right? Uh-huh. Like, our body doesn't work that way. So what goes in our mouth doesn't go straight in our blood vessels. It gets digested and broken down. The cholesterol that's in our own blood is what our body makes.
It's not the cholesterol you ate that makes your cell walls.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a very clear biological process that happens, or biochemical process, that insulin is one of the signals that actually signals your body to make more cholesterol, especially the LDL, the bad kind of cholesterol. Mm-hmm. So carbohydrates actually have a bigger tie, excessive carbohydrates have a bigger tie to the wrong cholesterol profile and clogging arteries. So it's very, very clearly known that people with diabetes have a very high chance of developing heart disease. Well, why is that? It's not because people with diabetes only ate too many bacon burgers with no buns, right? It's because they ate too many carbohydrates. They caused too much inflammation in their body. Their body made a lot of extra cholesterol, and there was damage in the cells, the artery walls, which then starts to, the body starts trying to heal that. So some of the mechanism we know how it happens, but largely the whole process of heart disease is still a big unknown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so all we have when we talk about heart disease is risk factors. Basically, they just say in your blood work, there's this rate of LDL as your lipid profile, and therefore you are technically at risk because these levels have been linked to this. And that's really all we know in some ways. But it's not that clear what causes all the heart disease, which is weird to think we don't know better than stuff like this. Yeah. Like, it's almost hard to believe that we don't understand nutrition better than we do.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, for some of the vitamins and minerals, for the vitamins, it's just been 100 years that we've even identified them.
So weird, though. Yeah. But it's like the most important thing we do that we think about all the time is eat, and it feels like we don't know much about it.
I mean, but isn't that kind of ironic that we have to even know about nutrition, right? If you go back thousands of years, people just ate the food that grew locally and they were okay and healthy.
You know what else? If we only lived, life expectancy was 40, almost nothing would matter. Like,
when people died that young, it was like of infections and things like that.
Yeah, I know, that's what I'm saying. But if we didn't try to live till we're 100, a lot of stuff wouldn't matter. Like, smoking wouldn't matter if you're only trying to live till 38.
Right.
Go for it.
You
know, so now that we had potential to live long, we see all these things as really bad and killers, and I guess maybe only in the last few decades and a couple of centuries does it even matter to even think about.
Well,
it,
but you know, we have type 2 diabetes used to be something that was only adult diabetes, and we have children now that are being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So there's something more than just the fact that we're living longer that's causing all these things to go on. It's it's definitely a lot of it's diet related.
Processed foods, probably.
Right, right. Yeah, and it, you know, it's convenience. I mean,
it seems like cancer is getting more and more. Like I hear the groundswell of more and more people just feeling like cancer in general is really tied to just weird and bad diet stuff. That seems to be people thinking if we can get cleaner, better food, we'd have less of that. And I've even heard somebody recently when people talking about ketogenic ways of starving out cancer and some interesting research that they think could be that way too.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some types of cancer that respond really well to a ketogenic diet. And by really well, I mean that, you know, has slows a positive outcome. Yeah, there are some other ones that doesn't make a big difference on, but a lot of them it really can.
Sorry, I lost my place. Let's see if I got a question here since I lost my place. Since we're doing this live, so Rhea asked that question. She says, do you recommend carb ups for women?
Oh, gosh.
When and how is the best time to do that? I don't know
ups are. We're going to bring this up. So this is a really, I feel this is a really controversial topic.
What is a carb up?
So there are some, I don't want to start any kind of a feud or badmouth anybody or anything like that. I'll just, at least one person that I know that's prominent in the ketogenic world that says that women need to eat carbs at least like once a week or something like that. Have a night where they eat a lot of
and
carbs.
That's unique to women that this claim.
Yeah, and it's actually, I mean, there was one research study that was posted that was saying that it was necessary for thyroid function. However, the research study that was cited had nothing to do with somebody following a ketogenic diet or low carb diet. And so, there are some people. So what I've seen, the people that do these carb ups and do really well with them.
What is that, a cheat day?
They don't call it that, and for some reason they still say that's a ketogenic diet. But you know the
Toby
science enough.
Toby sent me the same question. He's just a regular dude. He does other podcasts, and he says,
"Okay,
ask her, can we do cheat days?"
Yeah,
that's what he wants.
Well,
to know.
If you understand, okay, so if you understand, let's go back to the physiology, of what's going on in the body. So the same thing happens in reverse that I described going into ketosis. So your first part is burning off your liver glycogen. If you're going to have a cheat day or if you're going to eat more carbs than your body can burn off really quickly, then the first thing that happens, your body starts to restore liver glycogen. Yeah. And so, you know, for people that are interested in weight loss, you can put on 5 to 10 pounds, you know, in a week of doing that. But it also causes a lot of symptoms. So it causes a lot of gas and bloating because you're just gaining a lot of weight in one area of your body. Yeah. It's hard for your body to digest those carbohydrates. And if you're doing it for any kind of a health reason, like you're spiking your insulin, you're spiking your glucose doing that. And if you have any kind of a health reason you're doing it at all, that's absolutely not good. And one of the biggest challenges people have too is that it triggers that brain chemistry again. So you know what you go through when you go through the keto flu, you risk refed that craving. So if you know of anybody who's gotten off of alcohol or drugs or anything like that, if they have one hit of that,
yeah, they don't do a cheat day for
right like exactly the they the go air. Out of, they go on a bender, right? And the same thing
I,
for
I
most
have done that.
Yeah, for most people that have, you know, a cheat day or a cheat meal or a carb up, it's extremely hard to stop because of the brain chemistry part of that. Because
is there really like dopamine release with sugar? Like people always say that it's the same as crack, but what is that matter? It's not the people tell me that it's the same as heroin.
Yeah.
It's not the same. But what is
the
happening?
The way it acts in your brain, it absolutely is the same.
It just in the sense that heroin and carbs, both sugar, both give you some dopamine release. Is that
it's the part of the brain? It's the animalistic part of the brain. The oldest part of the brain is where addiction happens, and you know it's a complex process, but it does feed that part of the brain. And when it gets one little hit of that, it wants more.
Yeah,
and so that's why when people become addicted to carbohydrates, the same amount doesn't satisfy them and they want more and more and more of it.
I just think of that as blood sugar. I mean, I believe that I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying there, but I think of that addiction part of it is like that crazy way that is so clear to me from being on this other side of it, of the cycle of having high blood sugar and then low blood sugar. And I translate that and say, I'm starving I've got to have some crackers and some bread.
Yeah, so
that... But that feels like addiction in a way, but it's really crazy to look at it now. I don't have that ever. I never feel full. I never feel very hungry. And sometimes I go, oh, I probably should eat. Yeah, that would be good to get some food. But no longer at all do I go, oh my gosh, I'm starving.
Right.
And nor do I feel, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that. That never happens, no matter how much I eat. It's all suppressed or regulated somehow. And that must be blood sugar ups and downs.
Well, what you were describing, that feeling does sound like blood sugar. Uh-huh. But most people have both of it. They have the brain chemistry part, the addiction part triggered, and they've got the blood sugar issues on top of that. And so for some people, it's really hard to tease out, but my training and experience, for me, I can tease those apart and know the difference. Yeah.
So I also figure it would be interesting. Like I proposed a diet one time, just like a thought experiment. If you did a diet where all you did was write down what you ate and how you felt afterwards, and then every week you eliminate the bottom five worst feeling things that you ate.
Yeah.
Then if you did that for a few weeks, then you would be guaranteed to thin your diet out to stuff that you feel good after you eat it. And then if you went back and looked at that, you'd probably find it was low carb. You know what I mean?
Possible, yeah. Except for in the beginning, when your body's not used to digesting fat, it's a little harder. And some people have a harder time than others eating a higher fat diet at first. Mm-hmm. So there's some adaptation there as far as your digestion goes. But as far, I want to finish the carb up thing, because as far as for women, the only women that I've seen that do well with that, and again, the carb up is, it's a high, eating one meal in the evening once a week, or sometimes people are doing it every night, which is not a ketogenic diet, because you can't eat and even if you're doing it once a week, it takes another 3 days to get back to ketosis, and so you might get 1 day a week that you're really in ketosis. So so they're eating a high carb meal, like you know, sweet potatoes or something like that, or fruit, and they're, the only way that it works though is if you do it low fat. So if you do high carb, high fat, again, that's a terrible recipe, right? So they're advocating a very high carbohydrate meal in the evening. And the women that I've seen that do really well with that are the ones that are lean to start with. And they have metabolic flexibility. They're not
high
insulin.
High carbohydrate tolerance.
Exactly. And they're not insulin resistant. So,
yes, insulin resistant.
Yeah. So,
and that happens the older you get too, insulin resistance.
It can.
And that's when type 2 diabetes, when you just either don't make it or are resistant to insulin?
Well, insulin resistance, actually anybody who starts gaining weight. So you might have been developing a little bit of insulin resistance yourself, because that weight gain process is your body going, whoa, we're getting way too many carbohydrates on an ongoing basis. So you might have had a little bit, but you might be a lot less insulin resistant than somebody who, you know, gained 100 pounds,
I've always eaten anything I want to forever. Like, I've always been thin and just always eating whatever I want to. And, you know, when you see people that are 50 that you hadn't seen in a while, 50 years old, and all of a sudden their neck's different. And I'm like, I'm on that train. I'm going to be that soon, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I just feel like, let's get it under control now. But I know that, you know, you get people that are skinny when they're 30 will still be bigger when they're 50. Yeah. Just the way it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. So as far, you know, I want to close the door on the carb up thing. It can work for people that are metabolically flexible. Mm-hmm. There's no reason, actually, though, that women need carbs. And actually, women, there's a large research study that was called the Nurses Study. I don't remember what year it was from, but it very clearly showed that women who ate a higher fat diet actually had better health outcomes. So there's zero reason that women need carbs more than anyone else. But this whole carb up thing, it's popular people, right? They want to eat carbs, right?
Saturdays is my cheat day.
Yeah. And so it's not a ketogenic diet. It's, you know, more of a flexible diet. And there's certainly people that could eat that way and be healthy, but they're going to be people that don't have a history of being, you know, 50 pounds or more overweight, that don't have type 2 diabetes that run in their family. They don't have a history of having a little carbs and they can't stop. And so most of the people that I've heard that try that, then they feel really frustrated because they think, like, well, I tried a carb up night and then I end up binging for 3 days. What's wrong with me? And I'm being told I need carbs. So gosh, what's wrong with me? But they don't need them. It's all right.
Yeah, I hear you. So we're basically with the 20 carbs a day. What does that look like? What would you do to get 20 carbs?
I encourage people to just get those mostly from veggies.
I mean, so, it adds up so fast.
Yeah, it
if
does.
If you're not paying attention.
Yeah. Like, so, you know, I came up, I think you're kind of doing it the hard way by trying to do the percentages.
I've done the others. When I first started doing it, I would just say 20 carbs a day and I'd read the nutrition facts. That's the easiest way to get into it. And don't worry about anything else until you get used to it.
Well, I teach people a meal formula so that each meal they're eating, you know, a portion of their fats, proteins, and carbs, and so that by the end of the day, they hit their macros without having to do any math.
Right. I'm just interested in that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, some people, they like that, but I have people eat like a portion of some kind of protein, so whether that's, you know, chicken, fish, beef, pork, whatever they want to eat, bacon, or eggs, and then they add to that, like, you know, usually it's like 2 or 3 cups of some kind of veggies. Leafy greens, broccoli, cauliflower, you know, you can do a little bit
of
bell peppers.
You even have to be careful with beans and no corn even.
Yeah.
Certainly no fruit. And sometimes I talk to people for 20 minutes about this, like totally. I'm like, you know, and no fruit. Yeah. What do you mean no fruit?
I know. Isn't it funny?
What do you mean?
I think it's funny.
Like they can't even imagine.
Everything else sounds fine to them and they're like, no fruit, forget it.
But I think it's weird. It's not because they necessarily love fruit. I just think it's just feels deeply offensive to people on a level for you to claim to them that fruit is not good for you, which I'm not saying it's not good. I'm saying it's not ketogenic.
Yeah.
I try to clarify there, but it's just fundamentally people, their heads explode when you tell them an apple is not, you do not eat an apple at all.
No whole grains and no fruit. This can't be good for
you. But the fruit one just kills people. Yeah. Like, what do you mean? But pineapple though. No, don't eat pineapple.
You need a pineapple, right?
You have a tiniest sliver and you've already got 10.
No apples? Yeah. What?
So, and it's weird because the other thing that's freaking me out lately is that the vegetables are so low when I look at the macro, when I really investigate what it is. I was looking at pickles. I was like, oh, I can eat pickles and cucumbers. I love them. And so I was looking at pickle spear, which is a quarter of a cucumber.
Yeah.
5 calories in that. And I'm thinking, this is devastating. Like, even if I was trying to cut down on, like, just eating meat all the time and cheese, which I do eat a lot of, I say, well, I'll eat more vegetables. And I look at it and go, you know how many pickles I'd have to eat to get 2,000 calories? So if a pickle or cucumber quarter is 5 calories, that means 20 in a whole cucumber.
Yeah.
And that means I need to eat 100 cucumbers to get 2,000 calories. I'd eat 100 cucumbers if I was just trying to get my caloric intake.
You'd lose a lot of weight doing that because you'd be so full you couldn't eat them.
Or you'd have to eat like 5 pounds of lettuce or something.
Yeah.
Or 10 pounds of lettuce just to, if you really wanted to say, well, I eat all veggies and do this. So then it kind of makes sense when you say, I put 2 tablespoons of olive oil on here.
Right.
Or even a big spoonful of almond butter or coconut oil because then that's another 200-300 calories just in the eat in just the oil I put on my cabbage.
Yeah, and that's
so none of the calories almost are coming from the cabbage, but I still want to get it because I don't want to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it gives you the feeling of bulk because if you just had, you know, a 3-ounce steak and 3 tablespoons of butter, you'd be like, where's the rest of my meal? So
it's like, are the vegetables important though?
Well, they are. So I remember this a few weeks ago, there was a post in one of the forums I'm in that was saying, you know, do we even need veggies?
That's what I'm saying. I'm getting 10 calories from this.
And so I kind of investigated that. So I track my diet on chronometer.com, which is because it shows me my vitamins and minerals. And I wanted to prove to people that this was a healthy diet, right? Because I knew going into it that my nutrition cohort would all be like, you know, that sounds like it's not very healthy. So I wanted to do we need vegetables? Can we get all of our nutrients we need from like animal protein or coconut oil or whatever? And so I tried to put together a diet that was ketogenic, a one-day meal plan basically that met all the vitamin and mineral needs for the day. And what I found was that I did need to include some key vegetables in order to get there. So an unpopular food group that a lot of people freak out is organ meats, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to eat those anymore. But maybe in the South, due to chicken hearts,
they're more so in the South. Yeah. They're okay. I eat some organ meats, but it's not my favorite.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid of it.
They're the most nutrient dense. Nobody wants to eat those anymore. So if you're not going to eat organ meats, you got to eat some more veggies. Which one do you like better? But so, you know, I found
stuff in them.
Like broccoli, for example, is a great source of vitamin C. And if you're not eating citrus fruits, you're going to need to get your vitamin C from something else. So interestingly, there's some vitamin C in liver of animals
I read and saw a thing on the guy who was living with the in Alaska with the Inuits or something like that, and he was up there and said he ate nothing but blubber and fat and organs and fish for whatever, and for like a year. And then he came back and reported, he's a scientist, and they said, no, well, you're obviously a liar, because we know people that didn't
eat I remember
citrus
that. Yeah, yeah.
on the ships for 3 months, got scurvy, so whatever. And he said, okay. And they locked him in Bellevue Hospital in New York.
Yeah.
And for a year, they fed him his food. And he wasn't like on lockdown, but he was in the Bellevue Mental Hospital and said, confine me here, I'll show you.
Yeah.
And he said he had to eat all the organs, all the meat, boil the broth, and drink the broth. But he had like a 95% fat diet for like a year.
Yeah.
Didn't gain weight, was healthy, and didn't get scurvy.
Right, right.
Just to prove that was like that. Because it's actually in the digested, it's somehow in the fat. And in the liver and the whatever other stuff that winds up in the broth, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and
vitamin C.
The one nutrient that I found that was kind of the hardest to get a lot of was potassium. However, there's still some really good sources of that, like avocado, for example. Yeah. Fish is a great source of potassium.
Cool.
The other thing about potassium is that we don't have what's called an RDA, like an amount that they know we need to get in order to be healthy. There's something that's set is called an adequate intake, and the goal is 4,700 milligrams a day. However, the reason they set that was in order to lower blood pressure, to not get kidney stones, and oh gosh, there was one other reason that they set it. But they're all things that actually, if you're following a ketogenic diet, those things go away anyways. And so it raises the question to me of like, well, what's the optimal potassium intake for somebody who's doing a low carb approach? And that's really something we don't know, because there isn't research that shows like when people are following a really low carb, high fat diet, what vitamin needs do they have, and how does that differ from people eating a high carbohydrate diet? We don't know a lot about that.
Yeah.
So, but I was able to put together a ketogenic day of eating that met 100% of the vitamins and minerals. So, and that was doing a little bit of vegetables. So,
well, I'm not opposed to vegetables. Yeah. I just always feel guilty. Like, should I eat more? And I try to, and then sometimes I get frustrated because it's like, I got to just scarf down a bunch of these. It's not even helping me get to my, cause I have trouble sometimes getting to 2000 calories on this diet.
Oh, okay.
Like I'm looking for calories. Yeah. Like I better take another teaspoon of almond butter is what I feel like sometimes in the afternoon when I hadn't eaten a whole lot and didn't feel good. My friend Hane is a type 1 diabetic.
Okay.
And he got into this, and he and I do an emailer where we send out the recipes, and Toby and Hane and I do that, and Hane's been into this a long time and has helped me through it and sent me a bunch of recipes. He's a fireman, he's active, works out all the time every day, and is on this diet. And by the way, if you want to get on that diet, you can email, if you want to get on that email list where we share our recipes, then you can, anybody wants to can email me at, is it mattcarter@badchristian.com?
Yep.
Okay, mattcarter@badchristian.com is, I'll add you to that keto list, I call it. But so I think it's interesting on one hand because he never takes insulin. He doesn't have to do it ever. And he goes to his doctor, and his doctor can't believe it that when he checks his blood sugar, that it's regulated, but it's regulated by this diet.
Yeah.
And also, he works out all the time and is not under fueled. Like he feels, you know, and I've read and seen stuff like that. So is this diet work? Or I'll put it this way, here's the naysayer question is, yeah, but I work out, so I need carbs for my energy.
Yeah. Well, for the most part, unless you're like an extreme athlete, somebody who's doing a lot of sprint type exercises or what's it called, like the burst type exercise, those people do better if they do have some targeted carbohydrate intake. And so there's a couple of approaches that you can look up. You know, Reddit's a great source for that, where they've got a targeted ketogenic diet or a cyclic carb diet.
Yeah.
So there are some people. And again, it's going to be extreme sports or extreme workout styles where a little bit of carbs targeted at certain times can be helpful and beneficial for their performance. However, for the most part, most people, especially anybody doing like cardio or weightlifting stuff, just the average run-of-the-mill gym stuff or exercise, your performance improves dramatically.
But it takes a little while though, right?
It does.
It's not after 3 days you're not adapted for that.
Exactly.
Though, right?
That's where that kind of that 12 weeks or 90 days really things start to kick in.
Because that's where I know people have done it, and I've done it before, and where it's like, well, I'm not able to work out as good. I really need some carbs. But it takes even how long? Maybe 12 weeks or 90 days before your body's fully switched over.
And you know, it continues to improve and get better at it even after that. So
Do you think there's anything else? What would you recommend for people that are like, I'm really trying to work out here. Mm-hmm. What should I eat? Should I eat some carbs for workouts? Is there some other supplement? Is there something I can do just to help me go do this big workout that I like to do?
No. And the more times you refuel with carbs, the more you make your body go back into that mode.
But is there not a ketogenic thing that you can do to get a boost when you need it?
What kind of boost?
Energy, like you know.
Well, I mean, if you're early on in the process, it's just you just have to be patient with your body mm-hmm. and let it adapt.
But even if you've been doing it for a year and you're like, okay,
you should.
I'm going in for a big workout today. I wish I could eat a bar of something. Or how about exogenous ketones? How about that kind of stuff?
Well,
that's a whole other topic.
Exogenous ketones hasn't really. Well, gosh, you know, there are researchers that are doing a lot of work with that, and they're looking at the use of that for, like, you know, Navy SEALs mm-hmm. and different military applications and things like that. And so I'm definitely not an expert on that. What I've heard for, like, the average person, the best use of exogenous ketones kind of helps, like if you're traveling, for example, uh-huh. any kind of extra stress on the body can affect ketosis and maybe even kick you out of it, even if you're eating on plan. And when you kicked out of ketosis, that brings your appetite back, it brings cravings back, and it makes it harder to stay on plan when that's going on. And so mm-hmm. exogenous ketones can be a way in those type of situations that you can keep your body in ketosis, keep your appetite regulated so you can stay eating on plan and go on vacation and go wild and crazy.
They strike me, exogenous ketones strike me odd because it seems like you're eating, so exogenous means that it came from somewhere else.
Yeah, outside the body. Yeah.
So you didn't make the ketones. Didn't come from your liver. Right. They came from something else. And so you're going to eat it. But on one hand, I would think just like fat, don't you just break it down? Does it stay as a ketone? And then on the other hand, if you're just going to pee it out or it's going to be in your blood anyway, how does it help you if you didn't make it?
Yeah, so it can put your body into the state of ketosis where you get that brain clarity, reduced appetite, so the benefits basically of ketosis, but it does nothing to help your body make its own ketosis or become fat adapted at all. So okay. It's like a temporary thing.
Does it help you get back in if you've gotten kicked out or cheated?
It only in a sense that it regulates appetite and it lowers cravings.
Secondary benefits from it.
Yeah, but other than that, it does nothing to help you get fat adapted. It does nothing to help burn off that glycogen faster in your liver that you've restored. It does nothing to upregulate enzyme production.
And it seems pretty expensive. So it's very expensive for now.
Yeah, and I think that another area they're looking at application is people who are not following ketogenic diet or lifestyle, and they just want an occasional, that feeling in the brain, like, you know, that clarity of mentality, the mental clarity in your brain that you have when you're in ketosis. And so by taking exogenous ketones, you can get that same feeling and mental clarity. So it could mm-hmm. be like they're marketing it to company executives, right?
Yeah,
like you get this, you can work all night, or maybe college students or something like that. But again,
I see. So maybe it's a whole market in the brain thing or the new vigils and the new, what is those things? It's not like that stuff, is it?
Provigil? Prove it or something. That's one of the brands.
There's a bunch of brain stuff. I've never gotten into any of it, but it'd be interesting to explore. But the stuff that really does make your brain function better and feel better.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I don't know a lot about those either, but the other application that exogenous ketones could be for people like somebody with epilepsy, maybe that's mm-hmm. having a difficulty following a ketogenic diet, they may still be able to get that brain protection.
Yeah.
But it's still, again, not like as soon as they run out of it or go off of it, their body's going to go right back to overproducing glucose.
The ketogenic diet's been used for a long time to stop seizures in people that have epilepsy that are resistant to drugs?
Well, in about 1920 or 1930, pre any epilepsy medication. So mm-hmm. It was used as the primary way of treating epilepsy. It was what the only way that they had be pre-medications. And so, and it was very effective. However, when medications came on the scene, like which would people rather take, a pill or change their diet or give up their bagel in the morning? So people started using medication, and then that just became the go-to way that doctors treated it. And then they stopped people there was another option. And I'm seeing there is a bit of a movement back to that, but it's still not.
But it's effective though. The diet is
very
effective
for
that. And then you mentioned earlier something about it being, we've talked about a bunch of stuff from inflammation to aches and pains to mental clarity. Again, I'm not selling nothing here. It sounds like I am when I say all those things, but it's just they seem to be the case. And then did you also say something about depression? Do you think it had anxiety? Tell me about that.
So I didn't know the mechanism behind it. I was listening to a podcast. They're mm-hmm. great, aren't they?
Yeah, what one was it?
With I forgot the name of it, but with Dom D'Agostino.
He's the one that I hear talking about exogenous ketones.
Well, he's the prominent brain researcher in ketogenic diet and exogenous ketones, and I'm pretty sure he was the one that was talking about what they found in rat models as far as basically like curing depression in the brain that when you're in a ketogenic state that
depressed rats.
Rats. So, well, it was actually it was anxiety. So he talked about how the way that they measured that was that they put rats in a maze they weren't used to. Uh-huh. And the sign of anxiety for them was that they didn't stay in there very long and they very quickly went back to safety. Whereas when they were ketogenic, they would, for a long time, they would be in this new maze and they wouldn't get scared and go home. They would just be relaxed. Wow. And, you know, that's a rat model. So some people would say like, oh, well, you know, that's animals. We don't know if that happens in humans, but I've seen it over and over again in my clients that I work with and even my own son.
So I'm not aware of it in any studies, but that means it's not out there. But anecdotally, it seems like I've heard people say that.
Yeah. And Dom was talking about the actual mechanism, which at this point, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there is a mechanism where it basically takes away that overexcitatory anxiety state in the brain. Well, it calms the brain.
So weird like that. I know we just know very little about it, but if the sugar and there's dopamine and up and down, and dopamine's related to depression and, you know, reuptake inhibit serotonin, maybe like those things, you know,
you're
like,
just listing off a bunch of neurotransmitters.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying I know that those, like if that happens from sugar, that there's those chemicals are in there. I mean, dopamine is like, it's that thing, if you're not having that, maybe there's something not having that spikes and cycles of that stuff that would be even worse in somebody who already was lower in those chemicals anyway or something.
Yeah, likely that's part of it. But what Dom was talking about was a whole other mechanism, upregulation of other neurochemicals and neurotransmitters. And
I'm glad people are working on that, that's for sure. But I mean, it's hard. I mean, it seems like it's so... frustrating that our science isn't better. It's just really weird to me that it seems so important, like what we eat and how our brains work.
Yeah.
We're just way slow. It's just so, I'm not saying we're far behind. I know we do a lot of impressive stuff, but man, it seems like we could be better with this stuff.
There's a lot to explore still, Well, and even with epilepsy, they don't understand completely the whole mechanism of how ketogenic diet suppresses or stops seizures. They know it has something to do with upregulation of some calcium channels in the brain, but that's only part of it. And the anxiety effects or the anti-anxiety effects of it are a whole other mechanism. And so I'm pretty excited to see, you know, the next 20, 30, even 50 years that the research that will be out there and we'll understand all of the different ways that the body really likes ketone bodies and all the health benefits of that. And
yeah, definitely. I hope more people get with it. I got another question in from Hane who I was talking about. He said he does take a little bit of insulin. So,
Okay.
Sometimes he does take a little bit of insulin. And he asked, how is protein linked to ketosis? So you said that something about that earlier, moderate protein. So protein itself, you have to even watch?
Yeah.
By what system does it mess up ketosis then?
Well, so...
Too much protein.
So we know that very clearly and, you know, taught in school, anybody knows anything about nutrition knows that, you know, carbohydrates cause an insulin release in the body. Protein does as well, and at about 50% of what carbohydrates do.
Okay.
And carbohydrates in our diet are not essential for us to live, meaning we don't have to eat them to stay alive.
You don't need carbs. Yeah. You don't have to have any carbs ever.
Right.
Okay.
But protein we do.
Yes.
So protein is essential for life. So we can't not have protein. And so that's why we moderate it. We get just enough to keep us alive and keep us healthy and give our body what it needs, but not so much that it causes a really big insulin spike that it prevents ketosis or suppresses it. And so that's why one of the biggest differences between a keto diet and Atkins is that we regulate or moderate protein. Whereas an Atkins, Atkins is a low carb approach, and so they're not concerned with staying in ketosis. And for a lot of people, you can lose weight by
suppressing the appetite,
and not getting the huge insulin spikes and everything.
Still not ketogenic. Yeah.
But you're not necessarily going to get to that, the brain clarity, the suppression of seizures or pain reduction that you notice as well, or a lot of other benefits.
You're not really flipping the switch all the way.
Yeah.
In that regard. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. So, but protein though, you need it for muscle. So if you didn't eat protein, we would lose muscle mass.
Well, that's
one of the... And
certainly
somebody interested like Hayne in muscle and working out and firefighting.
Yeah.
He's got to keep that protein.
Well,
in
there. And that's the one thing most people just think of, like protein makes muscle, but it actually is essential for a whole bunch of other things. Did you actually know that our neurotransmitters are made from protein parts? So protein is broken down into amino acids. That's the building block of them. And we need...
There's 22 of them.
Yeah. Well, there's...
Right? I learned that in biology. Yeah. I think there's 22 amino acids that make up the building block thing.
Well, there's more than that, and we can make some of them.
Okay.
But neurotransmitters are all made from amino acids. Mm-hmm. Endorphin molecule, for example, needs between 14 and 22 different amino acids to make one molecule of endorphin. Endorphin is what we need for pain. Not only do we make muscles out of protein, but we also need it for neurotransmitters. Our enzymes are all made from protein parts, parts of our cells, our DNA. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So it's essential. We absolutely need it. So that's why we make sure we get enough of that. The most recent, and there's not a lot of agreement yet as far as like what the minimum amount of protein is that we need. So that's an area that's under investigation right now, and all the different prominent researchers, or like Dr. Westman and Volek and Finney, they all kind of have different ways of figuring out what the ideal amount of protein is. So I tend to go with 0.8 to 1 gram per kilogram per day. For most people, that works really well.
So 100 for me is reasonable. You think I should even go lower on protein?
How many kilograms do you weigh, do you know?
I know. I can tell you I weigh about 179 pounds.
So if you take, roughly about half of that in would be grams of protein, which is fine. Yeah. I mean...
Half of my kilogram weight in protein.
Well, half of your weight in pounds is a rough estimate of your kilograms. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So less than 100 would be fine for me.
Yeah.
90,
yeah.
100.
Yeah. And for most, like a really simple way that people can do this is like for women, if they do 60 grams a day and men 75, that tends to work really well. The more physically active somebody is, they may need a little bit more protein, but for most people, they overestimate.
That's interesting.
You don't need 200 grams of protein.
So
a day
then we're just back to like, really, we want to eat fatty stuff.
I yeah.
Mean. So
yeah.
You don't really worry about or avoid dairy. And then the other one I want to ask you about is artificial sweeteners. Like there's part of me thinks, okay, we're going to take this totally alternate approach, and we're going to use these crutches of maybe these other things that might be, they're not related to ketosis, but maybe they have other harmful effects. The sweeteners, and people seem to not like dairy, or maybe a saturated fat. I don't know what it is, but I'm wondering, by doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on some of these other things that would be less in a balanced, normal diet, are we at risk? Am I at risk of getting colon cancer for dairy or something else because of artificial sweeteners?
Well, let me look at your palm and I can tell if you're going to get cancer. No, I'm just kidding.
But I mean, is there a risk factor, like colon cancer from too much meat? How about that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about those type of correlational studies you'll see is that they're what's called epidemiological, which means they look at large groups of people and they look at diet recall. I mean, there's so many things that could be wrong with that association. There's nothing that's been proved that.
Yeah.
It's just like these societies that ate a high meat diet, they also had high rates of colon cancer. Well, what else has in common with societies that eat a high meat diet? But also, we were just talking about like too much meat isn't good for us anyways. Yeah. So maybe there is something to do with that. If you eat way too much meat, maybe you're causing an insulin spike as well. And maybe that's contributing to that. So,
well, okay. So dairy and sweeteners though. What's
your thoughts? Dairy is one of those things that's very individual. So some people tolerate it just fine. Other people are very sensitive to it. I interviewed Dr. Adam Nally out of Arizona a few weeks ago. He talked about how he was eating a lot of dairy in the beginning when he thought he was doing keto ketogenic diet, and he finally got a ketone meter and checked his blood, and he found that whenever he had dairy, it kicked him out of ketosis. So he was just really sensitive, and it was independent of how much protein he had mm-hmm. or carbs or anything. And so I had that same question then, and I just broke down finally and started checking my own blood ketones, and I had, you know, a bunch of heavy cream in coffee, yeah. and I checked mine, and I was still within, you know, the ideal range. So I'm like, okay, good. I get a free pass on dairy, but it's an individual thing. So some people are sensitive to it. As far as ketosis goes, I mean, the allergy side of it is probably a whole different thing.
That's a whole other thing. Lactose intolerance when your gut, how well you, how, if you, yeah, some, if everybody's different in those things. Some people, dairy just isn't good for them anyway.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly.
And so artificial sweeteners, what do you say?
So artificial sweeteners, I, you know, I'm not a fan of anything that's artificial, but setting that aside, let's, you know, the thing I look at is, does it affect glucose? Does it affect insulin? So those are the primary things that...
So with stevia, for instance, no.
Yeah, stevia doesn't affect blood glucose or insulin. So I call that a keto-friendly sweetener. There are some of the artificial sweeteners, though, that do, even though they don't affect blood glucose, they affect insulin, and that they can actually suppress ketosis.
Okay. Which ones are those?
Off the top of my head, it's either...
Splenda
or aspartame. It's one of those two. Yeah. And off the top of my head, I should...
Splenda is the yellow one. Aspartame is then in equal, the blue one.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know what is the sweet and low. Is that one has a different name?
Yeah, the two that I found that, you know, they're the most natural and have the least, have no impact on blood glucose or insulin. Stevia, very clearly. I guess there's a lot of other ones that go with that. Like monk fruit is another one that's a natural compound, and it is, doesn't affect insulin or glucose. Inulin fibers as well, which is often mixed with like stevia when they powder it. The other one is erythritol. It's more.
Oh yeah, I've seen that one. That what do I have? That I have it in one of my foods. I see that one.
It's in Zevia soda, and there's also a packaged version of that called Swerve. That's
I've seen that one.
Produced by fermenting corn.
I try to make some desserts, which is really good. Okay, so you said you're going out tonight with somebody. You're going out to eat.
Yeah.
How do you eat this way? Out to eat. The menus aren't super friendly to it, but what's your strategy when you're going? What will you eat tonight?
Yeah, well, it depends on where we go, but I kind of do the same thing that I teach as my formula. So I'll look for whatever protein sounds good to me. So whether that's like salmon or chicken or beef or steak, or I might do a burger with no bun is a common one I'll do when I go out. And then, you know, instead of any fries or potatoes or something on the side, is that I'll get a salad, or like if they've got some kind of low carb veggie, which is like broccoli or cauliflower or asparagus this time of year. Something like that. I'll just have that as a side. Ask for extra. A Caesar salad is a really good one with no croutons.
If they upcharge you, just don't worry about it.
Yeah, and I save so much money on food now anyways, because I'm not as hungry and I'm not getting like, you know, it used to be that I would crave something sweet every night and I would go indulge in like expensive desserts and stuff. And I save so much money now that I don't care if they charge me, you know, $15 for a burger and a Caesar salad on the side. It's like... you know, I feel happy and satisfied, and I eat
what I
want.
That's interesting. I was thinking about that because I eat out less because I just do stuff at home naturally, because going out to eat, I had to avoid this or that.
Yeah.
So I probably save some money on that, but I spend money on way better quality foods and you know, calorie-dense fat stuff can be expensive. And then on the last thing I really want to talk about too is I save a lot of money in alcohol because I'd normally drink several beers. I'll say a couple. It's probably more than that. Every night at home. Why wouldn't I? I mean, that's one of the best things in the world to me. I don't do that anymore at home, but I do mix alcohol in sometimes when I can. And my understanding is that it can delay or slow down or affect my ketosis. But if I can watch the amount of carbs and have either a low-carb beer or a liquor drink with a no sugar or sweetener in that, it's... I don't know because I'm not testing my blood, but I feel like that it can be okay. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so it does definitely. So if you have an alcoholic beverage, and again, you're going to do like the no carb mixers, like club soda or water or something like that, your liver switches over from making ketones. It's got to detox the alcohol first, so
jumps in line.
Suppresses your ketone production if you were checking your blood ketones. And this actually, somebody who's much more keto adapted has been doing this for many, many months is going to see your body can spring back from it much quicker.
I noticed that too.
However, if somebody in the very beginning is trying to maintain their alcohol mm-hmm. habit and be in ketosis, they're going to have a really, really hard time. So it's going to suppress your ketone level. From what I've seen, it doesn't completely kick you out of ketosis.
I mean, if you have a few beers, there's enough carbs that'll do it.
And the other thing is because it lowers your inhibitions, it
likely increases
your appetite. Appetite and increases cravings and things like that. And so it might be like a snowball effect where it makes it hard for people to stay on track. But for somebody who's been keto adapted or fat mm-hmm. adapted for a long period of time, their body can bounce back. So by the next morning, they're back up to that ketone level that they were at before. So I've seen that.
Gives me a lot of like mental, it gives me some pleasure to know that at least I can drink sometimes. So I don't drink every day, which I would prefer in a sense, but there's the calories from that. And there's no reason that's a good idea, but it doesn't start storing glycogen in my liver is the bottom line.
No,
just gets in line and says, hey, let's deal with this alcohol, which it probably thinks is a poison
stumbled
into and says, I got to deal with this right away. Then we'll be back to fat burning.
Right, exactly.
So it slows you down.
Yeah. And you probably noticed as well is that your tolerance is much lower than it was before.
Of alcohol.
Like one drink is equal to three.
Yeah,
now,
I had
three
drinks the other day and had a hangover. I was like, this isn't right. Yeah. It's actually less enjoyable to drink now too,
which is a
bummer.
And because it's making your brain happier as well, I found a lot of my clients report that, you know, they go into that thinking like, gosh, I don't know if I can give up my habit in the evening like that.
Yeah.
And then after a while, they're like, my brain's so happy now, I don't need alcohol anymore. Yeah. Or I don't crave it like I used to.
Yeah, but that I even mourn that a little bit.
I miss my depression.
I did. Maybe, I don't know. But it was just. But I do different stuff. Like it actually affects my whole lifestyle. Like I usually from 8:30 when my daughter goes to bed and my wife winds down and maybe she's watching TV in bed or something, I usually can do another 2 or 3 hours of work with mm-hmm. a lot of clarity. Like I just can sit down and learn something or read something or study on the internet or edit some music or do whatever I'm doing. I can do it. It's kind of like I've bought that time back in a way. And drinking and sugar would veg me out either way, because that's the thing that I just think it's really weird how with sugar and diets like that, a big meal with a baked potato, count me out. Like nobody's ever done any awesome work after Thanksgiving dinner or mini Thanksgiving dinner. Like you have a big supper with carbs, you're not going to be worth anything after that, or a big lunch.
The same thing with breakfast,
like
when they go
waste
have that
hours a day
croissant and like donut and Kirby mocha, the same thing. They go to work and
it's super weird. So this has been great. I think we're about on what we need to be on time without really boring people, but I think I could talk. There's a bunch of more questions I would like to do, see if I didn't have anything else written down. I really appreciate your time, and I hope you have a good time over here in the city today.
Yeah.
I don't have anything here. I'm going to try and get a ketone meter, though. I think that's enough. I talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
You think I can get the test strips for $2 or $3?
Well, yeah. If you buy them, I found them on eBay for, of course, the bigger lot you buy, the cheaper they are. Mm-hmm. The ones I got were like about $280 a piece.
Do you test your blood every day?
No. You
just know where you're at.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted validation. Like after actually interviewing Dr. Nell and him saying, I thought I was in ketosis for a long time. And then I found when I finally mm-hmm. tested, I wasn't. And so I was like, well, after all this time, I might as well make sure. And I got that validation. And I checked after a couple of foods. Like I wanted to find out if I was somebody who was like dairy was kicking me out of ketosis or something, or too much coffee also mm-hmm. for some people can do that. I wanted to check those things. I got that validation and I'm like, well, these things are expensive enough. I'll wait until I want to try something different or some other food that I'm questioning or something. So,
and so the meter, if you're looking for we'd want to be at like 1.5 to 3 millimolars.
Yeah. That's kind of the ideal, like nutritional ketosis
and weight loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ketone levels in your blood is the
gold
standard.
To get all the benefit, regardless of your weight, to get all the benefits of a ketogenic diet, that's where you want to be. Yeah, and they have the pea strips too, but they say they don't work as good.
Well, yeah, because there's three different ketone bodies primarily that your body's making, not primarily, that it makes. One of those is what shows up that in your urine, that the ketone sticks, mm-hmm. what are they called, keto sticks?
Yeah.
That is measuring that one in your urine. And in the beginning, your body is kind of sloppy and it makes too much of that, and so it spills over into your urine. So mm-hmm. in the first month, that's a good way to kind of, people like that validation. Am I doing this right?
Yeah.
But after your body gets better adapted, so that whole process we talked about adaptation is that your body gets better at it, more efficient, and less of it spilling over into your urine. And so, you know, a month or more into it, people use the pee sticks and they think, oh gosh, I'm not in ketosis anymore. Well, no, it's just your body's actually getting better at being in ketosis. So the one place it's always going to show up though is in the blood.
Yeah, I see. Well, you know, I appreciate this very much. Like I said, we have that email list where we share. It's just real small internal private thing. But instead of, I know there's a million good websites, and I'd love people to go to your website and everything, and I'll link it in the episode description and everywhere else, Carol Freeman. But if you want to send along a couple of special recipes that you like, that's the most fun thing, is just to share stuff. Like we Haynes shared with me a fried chicken, which I miss, and use pork rinds as some of the breading for it. And I just, to me, that made me so happy to feel like I can eat fried chicken again.
I've got a really great lasagna recipe that's with chorizo, and then I do this keto chocolate cream pie as well.
Yeah, we would love to have those. Yeah. So if you want to pick out, I know you probably have a lot of recipes and things that you do, but if you'd like to pick out a few that are your favorite, I would love to add them to that list of ours and share them. I'll tell them that it was yours.
I'd be happy to.
We'll link all your information and stuff in there. So I really appreciate the time and information that you've relayed to me today. I get a real kick out of that.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been great. So thanks for having me, Matt.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
Shh. Hi, I'm Emma.
And I'm Joe.
And we're the professional book nerds. Two Mondays a month, we interview authors and talk about their upcoming books, what drives them, and their go-to order at the cafe.
On Thursdays, we share recommendations and dive into topics readers face, like, how do I actually read the books on my to-be-read list?
You can find the Professional Book Nerds podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn more about us? Our website is professionalbooknerds.com, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at ProBookNerds.
We hope you'll come and listen, and as always,
happy reading.
That's what ransomware is all about. It's psychological pressure.
Ransomware, when your computer's hacked into and your data held ransom. Attacks are on the rise, and Russian gangs are making billions of dollars.
The moment I got that message, I knew our greatest fears that we ever have are starting to come true.
The post-Cold War era is over.
.com, The Hacking. A new season from Crowd Network with me, Katie Puckrick. Just search for .com, that's D-O-T-C-O-M, and subscribe.